This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Amiri Baraka was a poet, playwright, and activist whose influence and legacy is undeniable. His career spanned more than four decades and chronicled several significant literary, artistic, and political movements from beat poetry to blues music and black liberation. Amiri Baraka was born Everett Leroy Jones in Newark, New Jersey in 1934, moved to Greenwich Village, and became the first black author to document black music history with the canonical book Blues People, Negro Music in White America. After the assassination of Malcolm X, Amiri Baraka moved to Harlem and co-founded the Black Arts Movement of the 1960s and 70s. He was a prolific poet and playwright, but he also became an important political organizer. He led the Congress of African People and played a significant role in the Black Power Movement. The Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History at UNC Chapel Hill is exploring the life and legacy of Amiri Baraka with an exhibition opening tonight and a day-long symposium taking place tomorrow. We're joined in the studio today by Joseph Jordan, who is a professor of African and African-American studies and the director of the Stone Center at UNC Chapel Hill. Welcome back, Joseph. Good to have you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Moments from now, as they escape the traffic at 15501, right. We will have a couple of your colleagues who were also very influential and who knew Amiri Baraka personally. But let me start with you and ask you the history. Give us some of the biographical details of Leroy Jones, Amiri Baraka.
Well, this is probably one of those very interesting stories of an individual who was a little bit ahead of his time. He, of course, was very, very, very erudite even as a high school student, left high school, went to Rutgers, was not impressed with what he encountered there, and went on to Howard. And I've actually had some very interesting conversations with people that said they knew him at Howard and said, but they could never talk with him because he and his friends would be out on the quad having conversations in French. So they were not allowed to be part of those conversations. But he left Howard also.
Yeah.
He was very critical of what he said was Howard's approach to educating young black people, which he felt was just to prepare them for jobs and to live in a white world. So from there, he goes to the Air Force. If you read his autobiography, he calls it error farce. It's not something that he someone like him would be very, very attuned with. Right. In any case, this is when he gets out of the Air Force after 4 years. This is when he goes to the Village. This is when he encounters all of that that very, very vibrant scene at the time. Kerouac is there, Jackson Pollock, Hetty Cohen, who became his wife, William Burroughs. Just a wonderful, wonderful place for a person who was into the avant-garde, and he just jumped right into the midst of that.
More than jump in as a beat poet, he was a key figure and began to publish the poetry of of some of the aforementioned beat poets. Right.
In fact, one of the magazines, in fact, he was figured very prominently in the founding of several of the magazines that published poets that couldn't be published or wouldn't be published elsewhere, including Ginsberg, Hubert Selby. A number of folks credit him with doing that. And these were those kinds of underground little journals that we love to find in the antiquarian bookshops. But Eugen, the Floating Bear, and they tell stories of actually doing those little magazines in their living room on the coffee table and then having them printed and then distributing them themselves. And if you have them today, you have a wonderful treasure. Mm-hmm.
So he already has a voice as an artist. He has, you know, sort of, you can feel the political ferment. He doesn't like the way young black men and women are being trained in black colleges. Doesn't make it in the Air Force. Then he writes a book. It is a seminal book, and it is today still in print. Blues People, Negro Music in White America. Tell us about that book.
Right. Well, that book, as well as the follow-up, Black Music, were really the first text to come out that connected the cultural life of African Americans to the actual production of the art, if you will. And for many people, it made a great deal of sense. Why not base what they felt was the production of black music in the philosophy and lives that came out of those communities, no different than what you saw for European forms of music. So it was groundbreaking, but it was not only groundbreaking because of that philosophical or that theoretical approach. It was also groundbreaking because no one else had ever felt that the music even needed that kind of treatment, that it needed to be treated in that way, which was very, very much a serious turn on what we would call a black aesthetic, the development of a notion of a black aesthetic at the time.
And the idea that this would come from a black writer, again, exactly. This is 1963. We're used to the idea now of being able to reflect culture in our own voice. But 1963, that wasn't happening. He was among the very first to say, I think I'll be the one to write this history.
Yeah, and the thing that we have to remember is that he's doing his poetry. He's doing his essays in very serious journals. He's writing plays at the same time. And he's also publishing other people. I mean, other poets are saying that he's the one that told me to go get an agent and that that would be the way that I would be able to get published. So he's very, very much a force in the village at that particular point in time. And remember, 3 years before, he goes to Cuba and meets Fidel and Che and has all of those influences now in his life as well.
The currents are coming together, and I've heard and read that when he wrote the book, Blues People, his poetic voice changed,
right.
That as an artist, by listening to the blues, it changed him as an artist.
Right. Well, a lot of things, I think, were happening with him. One of the things that we have to also remember is that one of the ways that he supported himself is that he worked as a clerk in a record store. So he could spend all of his day and leisure time going through these pieces while he's writing. Of course, as you might imagine, it wasn't a record store that got a lot of business. So he had a great deal of time to bring his thoughts together and to still have those conversations with different sets of people.
Let's listen to a sample of Amiri Baraka's poetry. This one's called It's Nation Time.
It's Nation Time. Time to get together. Time to be one strong, fast black energy space. One pulsating positive magnetism rising. Time to get up and become, become. Time to become, time to get up, become. Black genius rising, spirit muscle, sun man. Get up, rise, heart of universe is to be future of the world. The black man is the future of the world. Become, rise up, future, the black genius, spirit reality. Move from crossroads back, from dead snake head, from weak funeral in slow motion, from dancing teeth and coward dip, from jibber jabber, pat me boss, pat me sandwich. When the brothers strike, niggas, come out, niggas. When the brothers take over the school, help niggas, come out, niggas. All niggas, niggas must change up, come together in unity, unified for nation time. It's nation time, it's nation time.
Amiri Baraka, that is part of a poem, his 1970 poem, It's Nation Time. It will also be part of an exhibit and a symposium at the Sonia Haynes Center in Chapel Hill, at UNC Chapel Hill. I'm talking to Joseph Jordan, who's a professor of African and African-American studies. And I'm joined now by Sonia Sanchez, who is a renowned poet and activist, a co-founder of the Black Arts Movement, and a longtime friend and colleague of Amiri Baraka. Sonia Sanchez, welcome. Such a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you, my brothers. Good being here.
Also with us today is Michael Simanga. He is an activist and scholar who authored the book Amiri Baraka and the Congress of African People, History and Memory. Michael, welcome. Good to have
you
here as well.
Glad to be here.
Sonia Sanchez, let's talk, if you will. And I know you just came in from the rugged ride from Chapel Hill to Durham, so I appreciate your being here. Amiri Baraka as an artist, as a poet, what was the power and impact of his work? And we can't separate the politics from the poetry, but if you analyze him and evaluate him as an artist, how important is he?
Well, I think that Brother Amiri was one of our greatest writers, be you black, brown, blue, purple, green. I think that what he did merely as a poet was enough to have put him in all kinds of given him many awards and put him in a lot of places where people should have known him. But what he did at some point after Malcolm was assassinated, when he came uptown to a place called Harlem, and he sent I don't know if you know, letters out to all of the artists. He sent letters. I still have my letter. He sent letters out to people saying, come, come, help me continue Malcolm's work. And so many of us referred to ourselves at that time, still have some of the earlier poem when you wrote A.M. after Malcolm, after his death, because he said we must continue this great work that Malcolm had begun. And what he was really saying is what we say in S.O.S., Calling All Black People, this anthology, is that the two people who really influenced something called black arts were the people who were what we call the originators of black arts were indeed two men by the name of Malcolm and Coltrane. And at the moment that this brother comes uptown to Harlem, he comes after Malcolm is dead and after Coltrane is dead, and they've given the impetus for this thing called black arts, but who's going to lead it? Who's going to say, this is what we are? Malcolm had changed millions of Negroes into black folks, but then they looked up and said, now that I'm black, what do I do with it? You know, how then do I move with it? And this man by the name of, at the time, Leroy Jones or Midi Baraka looked up and said, you know, I would pick up this mantle. I would then begin to tell you, we began this journey of looking at ourselves, changing ourselves, at the same time changing America, becoming self-determined in this place called America, you know, began to say simply, I'm black and there's nothing to be ashamed of. He did that.
And created a foundation in many ways. Michael Simanga, that poem, It's Nation Time, the idea that there is now an intellectual and creative foundation from which we can act. But that means recontextualizing our story. We have been treated as a separate nation. All of the metrics of this people are not the same by orders of magnitude, health outcomes, incarceration, even in 1970. If we see ourselves as a nation, that reconfigures the whole project. How important was he in creating that kind of intellectual and creative base from which to move?
He had great importance to that. In a very unusual way, as a poet, to become one of the major political leaders of not only the black arts movement, but of the black political struggle for self-determination. In 1967, when the Black Power Conference was held in Newark, Miri is the leader of the workshop on art and culture. 3 years later, at the founding of the Congress of African People in Atlanta, he's the political liberation leader and develops a strategy that he promotes to align the black arts movement, the black power movement, with the emerging black elected officials, which leads to the 1972 founding of the National Black Political Convention. And so he was very unique in that way as an artist to become the FBI deemed him one of the potential messiahs of the black liberation movement, you know, after Malcolm. And a lot of people saw Miri as, you know, the political leader at the time. And certainly this is during the time of the Black Panthers and Attica, and Angela Davis is on the run and then had been arrested and tried. So there's a lot of things happening. And in this space, Baraka emerges as a political leader, but he continues to influence art and culture with a tremendous production, which is one of the remarkable things about him. I mean, there are very few artists that we can cite who have the level of production that he did throughout his life.
Joseph Jordan, what's the connection you hear so often, you know, sort of what does art have to do with it? And Sonia Sanchez says, you know, the two leaders were Coltrane and Malcolm X. Well, who was it? Who was Amiri Baraka to bring these things together? And why did the arts play such an important part in this period?
Well, I think that there are several poles there. And I do want to say that Baraka had accomplices, if you will. And one of them is sitting next to me, is Sonia Sanchez, who was also an architect, along with people like Larry Neal and A.B. Spellman, Calvin Herton, a whole range of folks. So it was always a collective effort. And I think that was the strength of that particular point in history, is that you had people coming from different tendencies who saw themselves going in the same direction. And that historically was a novel, if you will. And at least in terms of art and politics, if you read Black Fire, which was edited by Baraka, and Larry Neal, yeah. Mm-hmm. You see them making that connection that that art is political by its very nature, and that whether you want to acknowledge it or not, every artistic production has an implication of politics within it. The other thing I would say is that you go to this next book, The Black Aesthetic, which is edited by Addison Gale, and you see a whole range, again, of people from Julian Mayfield. Amiri Baraka has a piece in there as well, and each of them spells out the relationship between art and politics. How you live in many ways determines where all people are going in the community, as opposed to you have a high art, a person who ascribes to high art here, another person ascribing to another kind of art here. This was a very, very formative period in Black life and culture. I haven't seen anything coming close to it since.
I mean, the Black arts movement got James Brown singing "Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud." So, you know, its influence in popular culture was very significant. Yeah. But also, if you look at the scope of the Black arts movement and its influence on other communities in this country, it is probably the most influential artistic movement in America in the 20th century.
Period.
Right.
How so? So in your sense, how so?
Well, you know, you wouldn't have NPR if it had not been for Black arts. You know, what we did is that we began to bring to America the whole idea that you can have art and it can be high art, you know, and it can be popular. And that's what happened at some point. So you got NPR, you know, you got all these particular programs. You got the Black programs on Channel 13 in New York City. You know, you got a brother, I forget, I'm blank on his name now. Going on 2 hours sleep, so you have to forgive me, who would do a program on Black women. You remember the program that was done on just Black women? You have Black women poets, you have Black women singers, you have Black women dancers and pianists. And that was an amazing show. People were shocked that Black women could be one that beautiful, that talented, you know, and they could pull a show together and show this kind of genius that was going on. It is out of the Black arts movement that we began to do the murals taken from what was going on in Mexico. So all over the country, the mural movement,
walls
a mural
of respect.
Arts movement became, and starting from Chicago, New York City, up at University of Massachusetts, the brother who did the cover of SOS, you know, he got people to go to Springfield, young people. So the mural, so I'm saying simply at some particular point, there would not have been an interest in Mexican-American artists or Latino artists or Asian artists or whatever, if it had not been for the push that we did with Black art, and we pushed it every which way that we went to. And we went from a simple thing, which was very complex, so the Black Arts Repertory Theater and Black Arts, we took it another step to education. We started, all the people who were involved, many of the people involved with the Black arts went to a place called San Francisco State and began Black studies. Can you imagine for the first time that young people would come into a university and see themselves for the first time? And that's what finally this was all about. We brought Baraka out to do the theater part of it. And just as what happened in New York City when Baraka did his plays uptown at 135th Street at the BART, people lined up lines all around the blocks to get in to see a play at a place called San Francisco. Also, the same thing happened in a Black arts house where people lined up on a Friday night to eat food, pay for it to come hear poetry being read by Ed Bullins, Marvin X, Baraka, and myself, and see plays being done by Marvin X, Bullins, Baraka, and myself, and all night long. But what was important is that there was no one messing with each other. There was no one scheming on each other. There were people coming distinctly to learn about themselves and about this thing called Black art because they knew something significant. So, yeah, you're going to have I'm Black and I'm Proud. You know, you're going to have someone sing about war. What does it mean? Ain't no good in war.
Sonia Sanchez, I'm going to interrupt you here. And please forgive me, but our conversation will continue on the life and legacy of Amiri Baraka, and that will continue on the State of Things. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking about the life and legacy of playwright, poet, and activist Amiri Baraka.
Whalers, we whalers, yeah, whalers. We whale, we whale. We could dig Melville on his ship, confronting the huge white mad beast, speeding death across the sea to we. But we whalers, we can kill whales. We could get on top of a whale and whale. Whalers, undersea defense hot folks.
That is a clip of Amiri Baraka performing his 1980 poem, Whalers, dedicated to Bob Marley and Larry Neal. The Sonia Haynes Stone Center for Black Culture and History at UNC Chapel Hill is exploring his work, the work of Amiri Baraka, with an exhibit and a symposium beginning tonight at 6 o'clock. We have details at our website, stateofthings.org. Michael, tell us a little bit about the Michael Simanga, who has written about Amiri Baraka. Tell us about how you met him. You were a teenage poet yourself, right?
I was. At the time, I wasn't very good, but I didn't know that until later. And I was very much influenced by the Black Arts Movement. I was a follower of the philosophy of Malcolm X. And when I first read Baraka's work and then heard him read, it was unlike anything I had ever heard in literature or read in literature. And so I followed him for a while, even as a young teenager. And around 17, I wrote him a letter and asked him if I could come to Newark to work with him. And he basically said, if you can get here, you can be here. And so I got on a Greyhound bus that summer and went to the summer I graduated from high school and went to Newark and spent several weeks there with his organization, the Congress of African People, and the local organization, the Committee for Unified Newark. And saw a high level of organization and community struggle in every area. They were trying to build affordable housing. They were working around health care. They had started a school. And then they had several cultural groups that were always performing in communities on the backs of trucks and in schools and things. So it was very impressive. And from that moment, we spent the next 40-something years together, you know, in various places, and spent a lot of time working with him and also debating him on several things, which was an interesting kind
like
of relationship.
What, like what? Well, and he was in conflict with himself often. Mm-hmm. His anti-Semitism is something that he acknowledged, said he had worked through to some extent. We'll talk about misogyny in just a minute. What kinds of debates did you have?
Well, probably the most important one was we were both in a Marxist organization called the League of Revolutionary Struggle, which I eventually resigned from, and that was probably the most difficult exchange that we had because he felt that we should continue there, and I thought that we shouldn't because the focus on Black self-determination in the Marxist movement at the time was not where we thought it should be. But the point that you made about his changing views, I think, is one of the most remarkable things about Baraka, that he was always seeking the truth. Mm-hmm. And as he discovered more, he was willing to change publicly and to talk about what he considered to be his mistakes and what he understood the truth to be at that time. It's very much in the tradition of a Malcolm X or a Martin Luther King that as they grew and understood the world more, they also were willing to say, you know, what I said before is not like Malcolm's letters from Mecca, you know, what I said before about white people is not true because I've learned something else. And I think in a environment where there's a lot of proclamations of public intellectuals that he was a public intellectual who was not interested in having a TV show. He was interested in the ideas that he thought would move society further and was very willing to stand up for those ideas and discuss and debate them and produce them in his art. And
talk about the power of those. Joseph Jordan, just the fact that he was often criticized for his radical politics and, you know, seen as sort of driving a wedge. Black nationalism itself was, you know, problematic in American politics in the 1970s. And yet he was always moving toward change. And so some of those incremental changes, just getting a black mayor elected to Newark, is something that he can claim success for, right?
Right. Well, I think that it didn't take very much in those days to be seen as a separatist. I mean, Martin Luther King, on one end, and you had people who were very openly advocating separatism on the other end. So there's a point. There's a piece called the Baraka Statement that we will be showing as part of the film festival. And in the Baraka Statement, he makes a very clear statement about renouncing this notion of separatism and understanding that that is not that there that he's in favor of working for the rights of poor white workers, that he understands that that's the way that the struggle should go. And I think that's the mark of an individual who is critical of self, who understands what's been going on and what's been happening in this country and takes the appropriate steps to analyze it. And I wouldn't say dispassionately, because I would never say he was dispassionate. But I think that it's important, as Michael is saying, to watch his evolution. And it's remarkable to see some of the things that he did. And part of it was talking about and advocating running for public office, which many black leaders at the time did not feel was the way.
That was the kind of weak tea. It was a kind of complicity.
Exactly.
And he said, no, not at all. This is the people have been killed for this.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And he talked, too, about this self-consciousness, the need to study and act. Let's listen to Amiri Baraka himself.
I think in the 60s and 70s, one thing is said is that the kids, we were serious. Not only the Black Liberation Movement, but the various, the white groups, the Chinese groups, the Japanese groups, merged with a group of Mexican-Americans and Asian-Americans in a group called League of Revolutionary Struggle. We were serious about that. But you have to build some stability so you can study the problems. You know, your emotion is not enough. You have to study the problems. And even writing poetry, study is important. You have to study what's going on. What is happening to us? Do we know? Can we trace trends?
Michael Somaga, how much did he stress that with you as a young poet, and not only studying but putting your words into action?
Well, it was a requirement, the relationship between work and study, between theory and practice. And so we were always reading and discussing. And then we had to work. It startled us, actually, when we began to be involved in the what was called the New Left movement, that people spent a lot more time studying and discussing ideas than actually working with people. And we came from a tradition of, you know, community organizing and working with people on a daily basis. And so the relationship between those things is very important. And he was a great example of that, because one of the things in my personal relationship with Baraka is whenever we were together, he would always give me something to read. You know, sometimes he would leave it on my car seat if I picked him up someplace. And sometimes he would just say, have you read this book? Here, you should read this book. He gave me the first copy I had of Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, which is a seminal book about the colonial relationship of imperialism to Africa. And he was a remarkable example of work and study. And then as an artist, that your art has to be informed by something. And he was very much an advocate for content being more important than form. But in his own practice, he was great at both. And I think it's something that as artists we have to aspire to, the, you know, a real unification of content and form.
Well, it's a difficult thing. And you talked about his willingness to simply speak the truth, no matter how uncomfortable it was, but always aiming towards some kind of political agreement. He wasn't afraid of Marxism and using the Marxist critique against monopoly capitalism, which really rankles a lot of people, particularly because it rings so true. But it as a political ploy, as a political tactic, he must have been warned off and decided, look, this is the truth of capitalism. They have to see this. We all do, in order to make any kind of adjustment.
Right. Well, if you look at it, I mean, he was very one of the things that Michael and I have spoken about is that if you don't understand his wit, that you're not going to understand much of what he does. So very early on, he did a piece called what was the relationship of the Lone Ranger to the means of production? And it's a one-act play. And that's what I mean. His yeah. wit came through. In fact, even in Dutchman, if you hear him talk about Dutchman, which has been accused of being misogynist, racist, a number of other different kinds of things, and you hear him talk about it, and the imagery of an opposition to capitalism, which is what he sees as the meaning mm-hmm. and the tropes that are present in the play, while everybody else sees a conflict between a white woman, who's a blonde white woman, and a young, preppy African-American man. So when you you have to come to him as a person willing to go beyond what is the kind of surface way that we regard or engage the arts today. He demands that you think. And going forward in his work, you still see that very ardent defense of the people against what he sees as the ravages of unchecked capital.
But you talked about the Dutchman and his other work and the fact mm-hmm. that you have to be able to see. You have to come to it with some understanding.
Right.
So my question is, was his direct appeal, do you think, to the intelligentsia, to the creative class, or did he have a direct appeal to everyday, to,
well,
to all of us?
And I know Michael has a perspective on this as well, but what I would say is that he saw at a point his audience as black people. In fact, that's why he left Greenwich Village and went up to Harlem, because he felt that it was important for him to do what was happening downtown, if you will, for folks uptown, so that they could understand, so that they could make the translations. But at a point, I don't think he felt any different. After he did Dutchman, he did The Toilet, and which is, of course, brought up accusations that he was homophobic, when if you really look at the play, it's exactly the opposite. So he says at that point, I'm tired of trying to make white people understand what I'm doing. He just says, forget it, that they're not going to. He says it's their own innate racism that allows them to grade me, mm-hmm. which he felt was inappropriate. So this accompanies his move uptown.
It's also, you know, Baraka could have lived a very famous, comfortable life. His talent and skill as a writer and his wit and his, you know, he's a very fashion-forward kind of cat. You know, he's very cool. Musicians loved him. He could have had a career writing about music and been very comfortable. But instead, he chose to go up to Harlem and to do plays on the street and in small theaters and on the backs of trucks. And then he chose to move back home to Newark and to live there the rest of his life. And he chose to stand on the side of oppressed people. And that's an interesting choice for an artist who could have been, I mean, he was the intelligentsia. He was a part of that. But he also decided that I'm going to use this in the service of those whose voices aren't heard.
And he continued that close to the end of his life with this controversial poem that, again, spoke truth to power. This is the Baraka, Amiri Baraka's poem, Somebody Blew Up America.
Somebody blew up America. They say it's some terrorist, some barbaric Arab in Afghanistan. It wasn't our American terrorists. It wasn't the Klan or the skinheads. Or the them that blows up nigger churches or reincarnates us on death row. It wasn't Trent Lott or David Duke or Giuliani or Shunla. Helms retiring. It wasn't the gonorrhea in costume, the white sheet diseases that have murdered black people, terrorized reason and sanity, most of humanity, as they pleases. They say, who say, who do the saying? Who is them paying? Who tell the lies? Who in disguise? Who had the slaves? Who got the bucks out the bucks?
Amiri Baraka, immediately after the September 11th attacks, that poem, Somebody Blew Up America. But it does lead me to the question, sort of, where are we today? Where's the Black Arts Movement? Where is that kind of activism today?
Well, it's emerging, you mean in the next generation.
Mm-hmm.
And I think many of them, as particularly as they're exposed to the Black Arts Movement poets and artists. And one of the important things about the Black Arts Movement is it was a multidiscipline movement, which is, goes back to my point about its influence in American culture. But one of the things that I experience constantly with Sonia Sanchez and Amiri Baraka, which I've never seen of any poets in this country, they're like famous amongst ordinary people. You know, if you walk down the street with Sonia Sanchez, people will come up to her who work in the store or, you know, just got off the bus and say, Professor Sanchez or Miss Sanchez, you're the poet, right? And that kind of influence, in addition to the fact that they are studied in the academy. And Baraka was the same way. You know, cab drivers would stop and say, hey, man, ain't you the poet? And so that relationship of an artist, a poet in particular, to just ordinary people is something that the Black Arts Movement artists had, because that was their intent, to speak to, for, and out of the experience of ordinary Black people. And I think that as the political movement is growing amongst young people in this country, that more artists are beginning to take that road.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Joseph Drummond, I'm going to give you a couple of seconds, but everything that he's talking about in his poetry in the 1960s and 70s, it's worse. Yeah. It's worse today. And so I wonder about that, but you've got about 30 seconds to maybe comment on that, and if you can give us a preview of what's going on.
Well, 30 seconds is absolutely impossible. But I will say this, is that a lot, and in some cases you have social movements that are very self-conscious and take a very direct hand in trying to determine which way they go. In some cases, we look backwards and we look at movements and we can then see what the path was, even though the people didn't know. What I see today is, particularly with young folk, is that they are trying to be a little bit more, and young and older folk who are participating are trying to be more directive and more self-conscious. If that continues, I think that what you saw back in the 60s will be reborn, probably even stronger.
Joseph Jordan, Sonia Sanchez, Michael Simanga, all part of the Sonia Haynes Stone Center reception and symposium and exhibit that begins today. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you so much for having us once again.
Thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. The website is stateofthings.org. Find more there. I'm Frank Stachow.